first want to thank those that organized this event, specifically Sarah Smith, who contacted me for inviting me here this evening. I can use every schus I can get, and this sounds like a quality schus to be involved with the organization Simintov, and I appreciate the merit and the honor. Thank you. At first glance, seems a little strange to have an organization that is primarily involved in helping needy chasonim and kalas to be able to get married and establish a family, and at the same time to connect that with a merit for people who need a refuah to have a refuah shleima. Where's the connection between marriage and sickness? Why specifically, and I don't know if the people who set up this organization had what I'm going to say in mind, but now they'll understand how the Rabban Shalom led them, that there's a tremendous connection between these two things. Hachnosis Kala, helping a young woman to be able to get married, to set up a Jewish home, is one of the things that are under the umbrella of Gemilus Chasod, acts of kindness. There are many, many different kinds of acts of kindness, and we know that Gemilus Chesed is something very, very special and important, something she'odam ochel peiroseyem ba'olam hazeh v'akeren kayemes lo la'olam haba, that a person eats the fruits of the merit of those kinds of mitzvahs that are basically between man and man, kindnesses between man and man. And since there's a benefit in this world, the resultant merit is also in this world, even though the major principle of reward is in the next world. So, Hachnosis Kala being a type of Gemilus Chesed is a very important thing. But Chazal seemed to attach to Chesed something much more than just doing somebody a good deed and getting reward for it because you benefited somebody in this world and the next world, but something much more significant. In fact, Chazal say, Kol HaGomel Chesed, anyone who does kindnesses between man and man is as if he believes in all the miracles that God did when he took us out of Egypt. And if he doesn't do chesed, it's like he denies them. There's a connection between doing chesed and emuna. On the surface, it doesn't seem to make any sense. Chesed is something a person does between man and man, and emuna is totally between man and God. Where's the connection? Why is a person who doesn't do chesed as if he doesn't believe? Unfortunately, there are plenty of believing people who don't do chesed. And there are plenty of non-believing people who do chesed. So where's the connection? We see that that connection is significant in another place. Avraham Avinu was the Amud HaChesed. He was the pillar of Chesed. He set the foundation of Chesed in Klal Yisrael. That was Avraham Avinu's main character trait. And Avraham Avinu at the same time was called Rosh HaMa'aminim. He was the choice believer. So here again we see there's a connection between Emunah, belief, and Chesed. What's the connection? In order to understand that, explain to you how a person comes to believe in God. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman asks a few questions. I'm going to mention two of them. He asks, how can we expect every 12-year-old girl and 13-year-old boy to believe in God? It's a mitzvah to believe in God. And that mitzvah is incumbent on every Jewish adult, starting at 12 and 13. When Aristotle, who the Rambam says reached the highest level of intellect that a human being can reach, the next level up is prophecy. That's how smart Aristotle was, didn't believe in God. So if Aristotle, with all his wisdom, couldn't believe in God, how do you expect a 12-year-old girl to believe in God? and demand it from her. Another question he asks is, there are those that do not count belief in God as a mitzvah. It's a foundation. It's not a mitzvah. It can't be a mitzvah. A mitzvah means there's a command. In order for there to be a command, there has to be a commander. You can come to somebody and say, if you believe in God, I'm telling you that God said you should keep Shabbos. But how can you come to someone who doesn't believe in God and say, God said you should believe in Him? I don't believe in Him to begin with. Who told me? Who said? There can't be a command if you don't accept that there's a commander. So before there can be any mitzvahs, you have to accept the fact that there's a God. But there can't be a mitzvah to believe in God. A mitzvah means somebody commands you. Who's commanding me if I don't believe in Him? The Rambam, however, counts emunah, belief in God, as a mitzvah. So who's that mitzvah for? People who believe already don't need a mitzvah. People who don't believe, you can't have a mitzvah. You can't tell someone God said believe in Him if he doesn't believe in God. So who's this mitzvah to? And lastly, he asks, says in Kriya Shema, Lo sasuru achre levadchem v'achare einechem. Don't go after your heart and your eyes. So the rabbis say going after your eyes, that refers to immorality, because you're drawn to immorality through your eyes, through what you see. What is going after your heart? That's minus, heresy, false ideologies. That's going after your heart. Says Rav Elchanan, I understand why immorality is going after your eyes. But why is heresy going after your heart? It's going after your mind. False ideologies originate in the mind of a person, not in his heart. So why is accepting false ideologies represented by going and straying after your heart? Basically, what he answers is the following. If a person would be objective and look at this world in a totally objective way, he would see there has to be a God. The world itself testifies to the fact that there must have been a creator, just as much as a house testifies to the fact there must have been a builder. It didn't just fall together by itself by accident. Obviously, it's the result of some intelligent action. Somebody planned the house. So too, the world couldn't have just fallen together. There must be an intelligent creator who created it. It's obvious. So why are there so many people who believe the world came from haphazard accidents, evolution, blind evolution? Just happened to be that there were, helium atoms floating in the space, where the space came from, where the helium atoms came from. That's like the free space in bingo. Right? That nobody can answer. If you don't believe in God, where did the first things come from? Okay, you got to give us something. So that's a given. And then from there, everything just by accident evolved. The helium fused into, the hydrogen fused into helium, and then they fused together to make all of the elements of the periodic table, and then through multitude of accidents, everything just evolved. So if it's obvious that that can't be, you wouldn't say that about a house, you wouldn't say that about a watch, why would you say about the world? Why are there people who choose to believe that the world came about by totally blind, haphazard accidents rather than an intelligent creator who planned it and created it? Says Rav Elchanan, because people believe what they want to believe, and they see what they want to see. To illustrate that, the Medrash says the following, that when God told Moshe Rabbeinu, he was dictating the Torah to him, and they came to the Pasuk in Bereishis, Na'aseh Adam b'tzalmeinu, let us make man in our image. So Moshe said, I can't write that. You are giving a place for the early Christians, in the future, there's going to be people who believe in more than one God, who believe in a Trinity. You're giving them a place to make a mistake. Because it says, let us make man, in the plural. So God told Moshe Rabbeinu, you write, the harotze litos yiten, the person who wants to make a mistake, let him make a mistake. Now that doesn't sound like God. Why would God write something that would lead people to make mistakes? Write it in a way that won't lead people to make mistakes. What was God's answer to Moshe Rabbeinu? God tells us not to cause other people to sin. Lifnei iver lo sitei nichshol. Right? Don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind. So why does God put a stumbling block in front of people and write in the Torah something that people could make a mistake from? The Bali Musar explained what it means as the following. No one ever became an apikoris because it says, let us make man. Because they look in Rashi, and Rashi explains that God was talking to the angels. And he wanted to teach us that a person should ask advice even from someone lower than him and not be too haughty not to ask advice. If God could ask advice from the angels, then anybody can ask advice from anybody. And that's why it says Nasa Adam. And the end of the sentence is clear. That God is not plural, because it says in the end of the sentence, Vayas Elohim Esa Adam. God in the singular made Adam. So Elohim is not plural. And it's clear that when God said the plural, he meant he was talking to the angels. No one ever became an apikoris. No first grader ever came to this sentence when they started learning Chumash and said, I have to go to the Catholic school down the block because it says Nasa Adam over here. Nobody in seventh grade the second time around ever became an apikoris because it says Nasa Adam. It's explained what it means. And no Baal Tshuva ever opened an art scroll Chumash and read Nasa Adam and became an apikoris. But apikorsim bring proof from this. Harotze litos yite. Person who wants to make a mistake will bring it from anywhere he wants. His desires color his vision. He sees what he wants to see. You want to be an apikoris, you'll bring proof from here. If you're objective, there's no proof at all. I used to spend my Sukkot vacations in New York. I attended Telzi Yeshiva in Cleveland. And I spent Sukkot vacation in New York at the home of a very chashuv rav, whose wife happens to be here tonight, Rebbetzin Leah Wasserman, Chaim Wasserman. I was their house guest for Sukkot. In fact, they were very instrumental in making my shidduch. So it's very relevant to tonight, the Hachnosis Kala. They performed that mitzvah for me and my wife. We even had our vord at their home. In any case, one Sukkot, when I was in Rabbi Wasserman's home, he got a letter that he showed me. A letter from a non-Jew who thought that he was Mashiach. This non-Jew thought for sure that he was the Messiah. And this was way before the internet. And he wanted to reveal himself to the world. And he found it very difficult to convince the world that he was Mashiach because it was very expensive to write letters to everybody. So he hit upon the following idea. He said, if I write to clergymen, I'll get the addresses from clergymen, priests, ministers, rabbis in New York, and I will send them conclusive proof that I am Mashiach and convince them, then I'll ask them to convince their congregations that I'm Mashiach. So I only have to send one letter, and with that I can reach hundreds of people. So he sent Rabbi Wasserman, who was the president of Rabbi Miller's Young Israel at the time, in the East Flatbush, he sent him a letter proving that he was Mashiach and asking Rabbi Wasserman to please convince the rest of the people in the congregation that this man is Mashiach. I don't remember, there were about 10 proofs. I don't remember all of them, I remember the first one. And the rest were pretty much the same. The first conclusive proof that he was Mashiach was the following. It says in Yirmiyahu, in Yeshayahu, that Mashiach will be lemala mimalachim. He'll be above kings. So he said, obviously it refers to me. Why? Because in the apartment underneath me, there are two dogs named King. Which puts me above kings. It's obvious that the Navi Yeshayahu was referring to me. Harotze litos yite. A person who wants to make a mistake, his heart leads him to a conclusion, will bring his proof from anywhere. No one ever became an apikoris because it says Nasa Adam, but apikorsim, use that as a proof. So God says, it's not going to help. Whatever I'll write, they'll distort it and bring a proof. So I might as well write what teaches the lesson that I want to teach. This idea that people see what they want to see, and it's not your mind that leads you astray. Because if you would be objective, you would see things in their true perspective. It's your heart that colors what you see. I learned when I was a young rabbi in Miami, I had a balabas who was a little eccentric, to say the least. But he was a little eccentric, at least. And one day he burst into my office and he said, save my daughter. So I said, what exactly is the problem that I can save your daughter from? he said she is going out on Shidduchim, and she met a young yeshiva bacher, and she is interested, if he'll ask her, she's interested in getting married to this man. And he went on and described this young yeshiva bacher as a combination of Genghis Khan, Hitler, and this is the personification of evil itself. And if my daughter marries this young man, it's the end of her and the end of our family and the end of the world. You must convince her. I can't. I knew why he couldn't, because she considered her father eccentric too. So I said to him, look, it's very hard for me to believe that a young yeshiva bacher is so bad as you describe him. So I'll make you a deal. Let me meet this young man, unbeknownst to him that I'm meeting him on purpose. I'll bump into him and strike up a conversation. If he's as bad as you say, right, I'll be lucky to get out of there with my life. And it'll be very obvious, right, that you're right. But if I see that you're wrong, and you're not reading the situation right, then you have to give me your word that you won't stand in the way of your daughter getting engaged to this man if she wants. So he gave me his word. And then during the week, I found out where this guy eats lunch, what's it called, during Bein HaSedarim of the yeshiva. And I went to that pizza shop, and I just bumped into him and happened to sit down at the same table and struck up a conversation with him. And after about 40 minutes of talking to him, I realized that the boy was not normal. He wasn't as bad as the father-in-law or the prospective father-in-law said, but there's definitely something not normal about him. He wasn't for this girl. This girl was a very nice, fine, normal girl. This boy was not for her. So I figured, okay, I have to keep my side of the bargain. It should be easy to convince this girl that this boy is not for him. It's not her father who's telling her, it's me. So I called her in, and I told her some very, very serious things that I noticed just in the 40 minutes I was talking to him of character flaws that this young man had. I don't remember what it was, but just to make it clear what we're talking about over here. I told her, I said, you know, I did some research, and I found out that this young man has murdered 7 wives already. She looks at me, she says, yes, I know, but he did it with such sympathy and empathy. I'm telling you, the guy's a murderer. Tell me he's sympathetic and empathetic. And everything I would say that in my mind was so negative, she turned around and made it positive. Why? Because I'll call Pshoyim Techasa Ava. Because you don't see things as they are, you see things as you'd like them to be. And she was infatuated with this young man, and she had feelings for him, and therefore it blinded her eyes from seeing anything negative about him. And anything that I could say that I was obviously looking at this objectively, she turned around with her distorted vision because her heart distorted her vision and saw it completely different. And that's why putting a stumbling block in front of the blind also includes helping somebody who wants to sin to do that sin. If they couldn't do the sin without you, and you help them to sin, it's called putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. Why is a sinner called a blind person? Blind people are very fine people. Why does the Torah use a blind person as a euphemism for a sinner? Says the Rambam, Shetaivis libo ma'avrim es einov miliros esoenis, because their desires blind their eyes from seeing the truth. Everybody deep down knows what the truth is. But if you have a desire not to see it, you have a desire to distort it, then your heart will distort what you see. Somebody told me a joke recently of how that works, that somebody sees things as they want and nothing you can do logically, intellectually can convince them. There was a person in an insane asylum who thought that he was a zombie, a living dead person. And he went around thinking all day that he was somebody who had died, come back, and he was a living dead person. So they sent a psychiatrist to try to convince him that he was not a zombie. So the psychiatrist is talking to him, rational, and nothing helps. Finally, the psychiatrist says to him, I understand that zombies don't bleed. Is that true? He says, yes, zombies don't bleed. He said, takes out a scissor, jabs the guy in the hand, and blood starts to spurt out. He says, what do you have to say to that? He says, I guess zombies do bleed. Harotze litos yite. Person who wants to make a mistake will make a mistake. And therefore, says Rabbi Chanan, emuna is not in your head. It's in your heart. If a person would merely be objective, he'd look at the world and believe there's a God. It's automatic. Why don't people believe in God and believe in the most fantastic, absurd things? The things came totally by accident, which is not scientific, not mathematically possible, because their hearts don't want them to believe. Rabbi Shamshon Feuerherz says, the mitzvah of emunah is not the knowledge that there's a God. Everybody has the knowledge. It's the acknowledgement. It's acknowledging that knowledge. That's what the mitzvah is. The mitzvah is to everybody. Be objective. You have within you the seeds of emunah. Just don't distort it. That's the mitzvah. And therefore, you don't have to be Aristotle. You don't have to be a genius to believe in God. You just have to be able to be objective. Aristotle, with all his wisdom, went after his heart and he didn't believe. And a 12-year-old girl can be objective and believe, even if she's not on the level intellectually of Aristotle. Believing in God does not depend on your IQ. It depends on your midos. It depends on how objective you can be and not subjective. And therefore, in order to be a believer in God, to come to emunah, you have to be an objective person. What is chesed? What's a person who does chesed? It says in Pirkei Avos, a chosid is a person who says, shali shalcha v'shalcha shalcha. Mine is yours, yours is yours. He doesn't get bogged down with himself, but he looks more to other people. He looks more to the needs of other people. And he's willing to be mevater on himself, what's coming to him, to give to others. That's what chesed. Chesed is being a giver, not a taker. The Michtam Eliyahu says, in this world, there are two kinds of people. There's people who are takers, who want everything from themselves. Their whole focus in this world is me, themselves. And there are people who are givers, who their focus is on other people. A person whose focus is on himself is wrapped up in his own subjective bias, desires, and he can't come really to believe in God, because his belief will be dependent on how much he wants to believe or not wants to believe. And since he sees everything through his own desires and wants, eventually he's not going to believe in God. The Bali Musar say, what's the difference between a mirror and a window? Both glass. From a window, you see the whole world. And from a mirror, you only see yourself. You know what the difference is? A little kesef. A little silver that you put on the window makes it into a mirror. A little kesef. Kesef doesn't only mean money. Kesef means kisufim, desires. If you have desires, then all you see is yourself. If you're able to free yourself of your own bias, your own subjectivity, and see others, and be concerned about others, not only concerned about yourself, then you're the kind of person who can be objective. You're the kind of person who will see God. And therefore, Chazal say, a person who does chesed, it's as if he believes. Because if you can free yourself of your bias, you eventually come to believe in God. And a person who doesn't do chesed, eventually will not be a believer. Because all he can see is himself, his narrow subjectivity and bias, and that's going to prevent him from really believing in God. So emunah and chesed go together. In addition, a person who's a Baal Chesed, who's a giver, not a taker, the Maharal says, is a more spiritual person. A person who's a taker is a more physical person. The more a person is wrapped up in his own physical desires, it's hard for him to free himself from his bias and his subjectivity, and he won't see God. The more spiritual a person is, the more he'll be able to have a connection to God. Now let's get to Chosin and Kala. Interesting Gemara. Many people think, most people think, I guess, that God created a male, a man, and then, as an afterthought, he created women. That's not what happened. The Gemara says, "B'tchila ola b'machshava libaro shnayim." God originally intended to create two human beings, one male and one female. And In the end, he created them together. He created one human being, one body, which was male and female together. How that was, either it was like a Siamese twins, connected at the back, one side male, one side female, or hermaphrodite, in one body, both male and female characteristics. That was the original human being. And it says in the Torah that, Vayikare Shmom Adam B'yom Hibarom. God called their name Adam when he created them. So very difficult to understand why God would do that. If God knew, he intended to separate them into two separate human beings, one male and one female, then why did he create them together to begin with and have to separate them? Why didn't you just create them separate? You know, that's the way things work here in Eretz Yisrael. Right? You ever know how they build a road here? First they poured the asphalt down. Then they remember that they had to put the pipes under the asphalt. So they rip up the asphalt, put the pipes down. Then they put asphalt again. Then they remember that there's electric wires that have to go out. So they rip the asphalt up again. God doesn't function like that. He could do it right the first time. If he intended to create two human beings, create two human beings. Why create them together and have to separate them? In a nutshell, the reason was the following. God knew that if he created one human being, either male or female, but enabled that one human being to be complete and perfect and able to reproduce itself and be perfect in itself, then that person would begin to think he's a god. God means perfection. I'm perfect. I can take care of myself. I'm self-sufficient. So therefore God said, Lo tov heyosa adam levado. It's not good that man should be alone. Because if he's alone and self-sufficient, he'll think he's a god. Therefore, God did the following. He created one human being, male and female, and separated them. Each human being now, whether they're male or female, no, they're not complete. They're only half of that original human being. So nobody could ever think that they're perfect, that they're self-sufficient. They can't even reproduce themselves. So every human being, whether they be male or female, knows that they need someone else to perfect them. So at the same time that they know they're not perfect, they need someone else to perfect them, and they're not God, they also can be like God. They can perfect someone else. So they have the opportunity to know they're not God, but at the same time they can be like God in perfecting someone else. I need someone to perfect me, and that someone needs me to perfect them. And then everybody knows who they are and what they are. If God hadn't created them together, each one would think that they're perfect in themselves. But the fact that God created them together and separated them, everyone knows now I'm only a half a human being. I'm not a complete human being because a complete human being was male and female together and I'm only one of them. And that's why the whole chasana revolves around the number seven. 7 days and seven brachas and the kala walks seven times around. The number seven represents shleimus, perfection. 7 days of creation is the perfection of creation. And a chasana is perfecting. Two imperfect beings uniting, and that's why a kala is called a kala. Kol, she perfects and makes complete the chasen. The chasen comes from the Lashon chitun, which means to connect. There's a connection that creates perfection. And without that connection, there's no perfection. Each person is only a half a human being. That is the idea of chasen and kala, the idea of shleimus, and that's simcha. When a person knows that he's complete and everything is working in harmony, then you're happy. That's happiness. That's the simchas chasen v'kala. And that is the most important aspect in service of God. It's not how much you do. It's how perfect it is. It's not quantity. It's quality. I'll prove it to you. If you sit down to eat and you have leftover from a bris, this gigantic 3-foot challah, but somebody cut off the end. And you have a little roll. And you want to know now which one. You want to eat both of them, but you can only make a motzi on one of them. Which one do you break the bread of the motzi on? The little roll or the big bris challah? So the halacha is that you make it on the roll. Why? Because even though the bris challah is much bigger than the roll, but it's not complete. It's cut. It's imperfect. The roll is complete. Completeness in Avodas Hashem is more significant than quantity. Echad hamarba ve'echad hamamit It doesn't make a difference how much you do. It's how complete it is, how perfect it approaches. So that is the idea of chasen and kala. Chasen and kala is an idea of shlemus, of reaching towards perfection, of really realizing that you're imperfect and that you need to reach out to get perfect, and you need to also help other people reach their perfection. When a person is sick, why does the Rabban Hashem Chas V'Shalom make people sick? It's not necessary to punish them from their sins or whatever, that's not the case. But the Rabban Hashem Chas V'Shalom sometimes wants to give a person an incentive to strengthen their emunah. Sometimes a person's well, he takes everything for granted. And you take for granted breathing and eating and walking and everything. And then all of a sudden, something stops you in your tracks. And you can't eat so well anymore, and you're laying in bed, and you can't get up and walk. And you begin to think that maybe things just don't happen. Maybe I have to turn to the Rabban Shalom. He's the one who gives me the power to walk and the power to eat and the power to function. So if the Rabban Shalom wants to give a person an incentive to strengthen their emunah, that's one reason. Secondly, when a person is sick, they are missing a certain perfection. Something is missing. Something is imperfect, lacking in them. And it gives them a desire to become well and to become more perfect, which is also part of what this world is all about. So sometimes the Rabban Shalom realizes that for a person's sake, they need that incentive to turn to God and say, Rifa'enu Hashem v'nei rafei, Rabban Shalom, if you heal me, I'll be healed, and if not, not. And I can't take all of life's functions for granted, because when something goes wrong, then you can't take it for granted anymore. And where can I turn? All the doctors tell me, well, we can't guarantee anything. So who can? Only God. So it strengthens your emunah. It also strengthens your desire for perfection. You feel imperfect. You want to get that perfection. So sickness is an incentive for those two points. Strengthening emunah and strengthening your quest for perfection. Chesed, specifically the chesed of chasen and kala, do strengthen both of those things. Doing chesed makes you a greater believer because it makes you a more objective person, like we said. And chasen v'kala inspires you to seek perfection because that's what it's all about. So if the purpose of sickness sometimes is to give a person the incentive to be a bigger maimon and to be a greater seeker of perfection, what greater schus could there be than doing chesed, and specifically the chesed of chasen v'kala? Because the chesed of chasen v'kala achieves what sickness is supposed to achieve. So whoever founded this organization, I assume that it was Mrs. Sarah Smith, was a Navi. Because she knew this, even though she probably didn't think about it when she did it. But it's very, very relevant, very auspicious, that this chus specifically, of helping chasen v'kala, is specifically something that helps emunah, and that helps the quest for perfection, and that is the greatest chus a person should get well for a refuah shleimah. It's interesting that these things that we mentioned, emunah, bitachon, having a connection with God, trusting, believing in God, refuah, right? All of these things have something in common also with geula. And geula, redemption, is also, being healed is also being redeemed. Because a person who's sick is like he's in galus. The Chafetz Chaim says that galus is like a hospital. The Jewish people are sick, they have to be in galus, they have to be in hospital. As long as you're sick, it's good to be in the hospital. When you get better, then it's good to leave the hospital. There are three shleimas that we mention every day. Emunah shleima, an imam in the emunah shleima, teshuva shleima, v'hachazireinu b'seshuva shleima, refua shleima, refueinu Hashem v'nei rafei, right? V'alei refua shleima l'chol makoseinu, and geula shleima. Goleinu geula shleima. Those three letters, emunah, tshuva, refua, geula, spell esrig. The esrig represents a tzaddik. Tzaddik is a person who has emuna shlema, which comes from doing chesed. He has the tshuva shlema, which connects you to the Rabbanu Shel Olam, once you have that emuna, and that leads to a refuah shlema, because that's the purpose of why people get sick, to strengthen their emuna, to strengthen their tshuva, and then they get a refuah shlema. And all of that leads to the geula shlema, and it says, kol ha-mesameach chosen bekala. Whoever makes a chosen and kala happy, you can do that by dancing in front of them, making them smile, but I guarantee you, you make them a lot happier if you give them the means to be able to set up a home and to get married, right? So dancing at a chasen is a big mitzvah, but contributing to Project Simintov is even a bigger mitzvah. And ha-mesameach chosen bekala is ki'ilu bona echad mi'churvas Yerushalayim. It's like you built one of the desolated places of Yerushalayim, and some say it means the place. It's like you built the Beis HaMikdash, because that leads to the Geula Shleima. So Yitz Hashem, by doing Chesed, by specifically Hachnosis Kala, you'll come to Emuna Shleima and to Shuva Shleima, and that will be a tremendous schus for Refuah Shleima, for all those who need that schus, and ultimately it'll lead to the Geula Shleima, B'mheirah V'yomim.